Well, welcome back to lesson five of our Introduction to American Law. My name is Richard Clem. This is part of a continuing legal education program for attorneys, serving as kind of a review of your law school days. Also might be of interest to some non-attorneys, especially if you're pondering the idea of possibly going to law school and wondering whether this law thing is right for you. Today, we are going to, in lesson number five, which we're recording today on April 9th, 2020, we are going to be looking at Chapter 5 of our text, which is Law 101 by Feynman. We're going to be looking at Chapter 5, pages 141 through 178, covering the topic of tort law. So for those of you who went to law school, that was when your friends and relatives asked you what you were studying, you could tell them that you were studying torts. And you would give this word that people didn't really, had never really heard before, didn't really understand. So you got to sound really smart studying the subject of tort law. The word tort is basically derived from the root for the word for twisted, and it deals with twisted behavior that other people might commit. In general, we're looking a tort law is really defined as a tort is really defined as a wrongful act. When you commit some kind of wrongful act against some other person, well, then that person can sue you and get some money from you to compensate them for their damages under the law of torts. And probably the most famous tort case of all that's introduced in the chapter, everybody seems to have an opinion about this case, and that, of course, is the McDonald's coffee case. And that's often cited as, frankly, it's often cited by people who don't really understand all of the facts going on in the case, because everybody's been in a situation where they spilled something on themselves, and they just kind of deal with the situation, and nobody gets sued. For example, one time I was on a flight with Northwest Airlines at the time. They're now part of Delta Airlines. I wound up with coffee spilled all over me. And it was, I think it was pretty clearly the airline's fault that this coffee got spilled, because the flight attendant wasn't really paying enough attention. Also the kid in the seat in front of me kept rocking the seat back and forth, which caused it to spill on my tray table. So let's say that was Northwest Airlines' fault. Well, I could have sued them over that, but I never did. I never bothered suing them over that, because frankly, it really wasn't that big of a deal. And other people have obviously been in a situation like that, where coffee has been spilled on them, and it's really not that big a deal. In this case, I just suffered a little bit of indignity by, when I got to my destination, having to walk around the airport with wet pants, which looked a little bit embarrassing. But I really didn't have any damages. I didn't even have a dry cleaning bill, because I was just wearing jeans on this flight. So it washed out just fine, other than a slight insult to my dignity. No real harm was done. So I didn't sue over the spilled coffee. So why did this woman who had coffee spilled on her sue over it? If you read the text, you'll see that maybe her case was quite a bit more severe than my case of coffee being spilled on me. She had very severe burns because the coffee was not Northwest Airlines had the foresight to not serve scalding hot coffee in an environment where it might get spilled. So when it did spill on me, it was not nearly hot enough to cause me any injury. Whereas the coffee served by McDonald's to I believe it was to a drive-up window customer was nearly boiling. It was like 211 degrees or something. So it was too hot to drink. And McDonald's served it that way because they thought it would be more convenient, because then when you get to your destination and you're ready to drink the coffee, then it's cooled off to the proper temperature. But it was kind of an unsafe situation, which a jury, after hearing all the evidence, concluded that it was really kind of unsafe to hand a container of 211-degree liquid to somebody in a motor vehicle who's going to be driving around, bouncing around, and so forth. So that case, I think when you look at the facts of it, especially the severe injuries that the person had, it wasn't quite that unreasonable. In that case, the jury also awarded some punitive damages, were pretty substantial, but they got reduced quite a bit. So oftentimes that case is cited, again, maybe by people who don't fully understand the facts of the case, as an abuse of the tort system. But on the other hand, if you look at it, well, maybe it was kind of a showed that the tort system worked, that this woman was fairly compensated for her injuries. So there are two ways of looking at everything, but that kind of the quintessential case, the McDonald's hot coffee case, is often cited as an example of the need for tort reform, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But maybe it's not. But that's what torts is about. Torts is, can you sue somebody because of somebody else's wrongful conduct, or from the derivation of the word, their twisted conduct. Tort laws traditionally, one individual suing one other individual for damages for the things that that other individual did wrong. And the author points out that the law of torts might be pretty well suited for that. Maybe the law of torts struggles a little bit when it deals with situations of mass torts. A large scale injury, things arising out of, say, 9/11, or going back a little bit further, Bhopal, one act of negligence causing harm to a lot of people. I'll tell you what that word negligence means a little bit later on. So traditionally the law of torts developed around the idea of one individual named the tortfeasor, the person who does the bad thing. We call them the tortfeasor. So that as a lawyer, that's another big interesting word that we learned. But the word tortfeasor really just means the wrongdoer. Somebody who commits a tort is a tortfeasor. So like I say, the law of torts kind of evolved around one individual tortfeasor injuring one victim. But that law has to be applied maybe somewhat problematically in situations involving mass torts where there are a lot of victims. That's one distinction the author notes. But in general, though, the same kinds of principles apply. But in general, the law of torts covers injuries for which somebody else is. So in general, the law of torts is the body of law that tells us who is responsible. If there is an injury to somebody for which somebody else is responsible, the law of torts tells us who that responsible party is and how much they have to pay. There are generally three goals of tort law identified by the author. First of all, the need to compensate people. If you are injured, compensation, put you back in your in where you were before the injury occurred. So if somebody damages your property, well, you're compensated for the loss of value of the property, or the amount of money that it would cost you to replace that property. If you have to pay medical bills, you're compensated for those medical bills. If you're permanently injured in some way, or injured for a period of time, Then it gets a little bit more problematic, but that's still the goal. Because I suffered pain for a whole year because of this injury. How much money is that pain worth? It's kind of hard to put that in dollar figures, but that's in general the only thing that tort law can do, is to give money to people who are injured. So that's the first goal of the system, is compensation. Secondly, it's designed to serve as an incentive to people to act properly, to refrain from doing bad things to other people, to refrain from punching people, or to refrain from what we call negligence. In other words, it serves as an incentive to people to be careful. Because negligence, that we'll talk about in a little bit more detail, is basically the opposite of being careful. So this system is designed as an incentive to be careful. One of the reasons I don't drive 100 miles an hour down a residential street is because I might crash into somebody. And if I crash into somebody, I'll have to pay a lot of money. So one of my reasons for being careful when I drive on the streets is being careful so I don't have to pay money. And then the third goal of the system, there's just a general idea of fairness. We want, it's not fair that you were out driving 100 miles an hour and I got injured. So fairness is one of the three goals of the law of torts. Now, there are alternatives to the tort law system. What we're talking about is from that evolved from the common law of England and came to America to meet those three goals, to compensate people, to provide an incentive to be careful, and to provide some fairness. There are other ways that it can be done, and there are other ways that it is done, even under our legal system, kind of in parallel with the tort system. For example, we have the criminal law that we'll talk about later. That's also certainly an incentive for me to be careful. If I decide to go out drunk driving, one of the reasons I would not do that is because I'm concerned about injuring somebody and I don't want to have to pay for those injuries. Another big incentive for me not to do that is the fact that there's a criminal law against it, regardless of whether or not I hit a victim, there will be some consequences from the criminal law system. I'll wind up spending some time in jail. That's my incentive to be careful. The criminal law perhaps provides some compensation to injured people, because a lot of times the verdict or the judgment and the sentence in a criminal case will include restitution. So to a certain extent, that compensatory function is taken care of there. And also there are regulatory systems even outside the criminal law. So for example, if I want to practice medicine, one of the reasons why I want to be really careful when I practice medicine is that I don't want to injure people because they might sue me. But also there's a very strict regulatory system for medical doctors. I can't just decide that I'm going to become a doctor and start treating patients. I need to get a license from the state, and they have very strict requirements. Like I have to go to medical school. A lot of nitpicky little requirements like that before I can start treating injured people. So that regulatory system also provides that incentive to be careful. And the compensatory function can also be taken care of through socialized medicine of some form or another. If we had socialized medicine where the government treated all injuries, that would take care of at least part of that compensatory function of the tort law. So we think of our tort system as being pretty enshrined in the natural law, but again, there are alternatives to it. So it always is a good idea to remember that it's not the only possible way of achieving those functions. One thing that the in contrast to those other functions, the author points out that the tort system is, well, it's self-financing. You know, we compensate victims, we have people be careful, we provide some fairness, but in general, tax dollars don't go into that system. A little bit of tax dollars do, because we have to pay the judge's salary, but in general, that system is pretty well self-financing. The any money that gets paid into the system is paid by the person who's at fault, and also the availability of contingent fees that we'll talk about a little bit later, where you know the lawyer gets a percentage of the fee, that makes the whole system somewhat self-financing. It's not financed by tax dollars. Now, of course, you know, when I pay for a ladder, we'll talk about well, that has a tort tax built into it. Because the manufacturer of that ladder realizes that some people are going to fall off the ladder and sue the ladder company. And of course, ultimately, that price is going to be included in the price of the product in what some people call a tort tax. So that's why when tort reformers and come around, somebody who believes in tort reform believes that the courts really have gone overboard on the compensation, and really what they ought to look at a little bit more is the fairness aspect of it. And one of the things that's unfair is, that tort tax, our ladders are too expensive because they're financing this tort system of compensation. And that's really not fair to the ladder manufacturers and to the consumers. Consumers of ladders, who use them with extreme caution and never get injured, they still have to pay part of this tort tax for the people who do use them and get injured because maybe the courts went overboard on compensation. I'm a little bit sympathetic to the tort reformers. There certainly are cases that we can point to where, you know, some individual case where the system has seemingly run amok. But a lot of times when you look at the popular cited cases, such as the McDonald's hot coffee case, and if you look at that a little bit deeper, you realize, well, maybe that system hasn't run amok because that was scalding hot coffee. It was not the same as the cup of coffee that spilled on me in an airplane. This cup of coffee was, like 211 degrees, very dangerous if spilled, and kind of foreseeable. You're kind of understandable that if you hand a cup of coffee to somebody in the through the window of a moving car, that it might get spilled somewhere along the way. So maybe they should have been more careful. Maybe that is not a good example for those calling for tort reform. The opponents of tort reform say that there really is an incentive to safety built into the tort system, and that it works. And the example that the author gives is a rickety stairway at Niagara Falls, and it's kind of an interesting example because this rickety stairway that looked kind of dangerous, you know, looked kind of old and decrepit, looked like you, if you walked on these stairs and hit the wrong spot, you'd plummet and go over Niagara Falls. So they looked kind of dangerous. So the person recounting this, one of his kids asked him, is this safe to go on these stairs? And if I had just encountered those rickety stairways, off in the middle of nowhere, I very well might have said, they don't look very safe. But instead, his response, well, they must be safe. The stairways must be safe because if the stairways weren't safe, they would close it down. Because if the stairway was unsafe, they would realize that people would be injured on the stairways, and they would sue them into bankruptcy. So there's kind of this assumption that there's a they out there somewhere who's realizes that they're going to get sued if something bad happens. So if I go on a ride in an amusement park, well, it looks very dangerous. But, well, I don't see any dead bodies. And also, I realize, though, that if there were any dead bodies, it would be kind of hard to cover them up because the relatives of those dead bodies would sue the owner of the amusement park ride into bankruptcy. So I can look at it and I say, it must be safe because otherwise they would have closed it down because they would have feared getting sued. So we can, so in a sense, that means the system is working. That yes, the it is motivating these people to be careful, to have these stairs be careful, even if they look unsafe. We have somewhat of an assurance that they really are safe. On the other side of it, though, the mantra of tort reformers is often the words personal responsibility. So, if I see these rickety stairs and I start climbing these rickety stairs and I fall down and hurt myself, well, it's they kind of have a good point. I should have taken some personal responsibility. I saw these unsafe stairway and I nonetheless started climbing them. I should have used a little bit of personal responsibility. They kind of have a point there, and in a way, the mere existence of the tort system kind of serves as an incentive to people or kind of an assurance that they don't need to use their own personal responsibility. Now, incidentally, as a negotiating tip to those who are attorneys, or even if you're not an attorney, when these debates come up, I always, whichever side I'm on, I always try to be the first one to use the word personal responsibility, because because that you kind of beat them to the punch. I had one case I was involved in at one time when somebody was getting some interference to their telephone, and clearly the law was on the side of my client who was allegedly causing this interference, and the police were involved because even though the police didn't have jurisdiction, the police were involved. So in my contact with the police department, I pointed out that, first of all, look at the back of the guy's phone. And on the back of his phone, we looked it up online. There's a sticker saying this phone is susceptible to interference. That's just tough. It's susceptible to interference because it's a cheap phone. If you want to be free of interference, you have to buy a better phone. Those were not the exact words used on the sticker, but that's pretty much what it said. So I, I kind of advised the police officers who were going to be having to deal with this situation where they really didn't have any jurisdiction anyway. I pointed out to them, as a matter of personal responsibility, the person really ought to make sure that they get a telephone that does not have that sticker on it, that does not say it's susceptible to interference. Because, yeah, they might have to call 911. That's what they said. They said, well, what if we have to call 911? Our phone isn't working. Well, yeah, that very well could be the case. So you really ought to exercise some personal responsibility. Whereas, I think if I hadn't been the first one to say that, I think that owner, who I never had any direct dealing with, fortunately, I was just kind of advising the police officers. I suspect that other person, if I hadn't said that, he might have come up with the words personal responsibility. This other person has to take some personal responsibility to not interfere with my telephone. So, yeah, personal responsibility is a big thing. That's sometimes the mantra of the tort reformers. But there are two sides to the personal responsibility question. If you have a set of rickety stairways, well, maybe you should take some personal responsibility and fix those rickety stairs rather than just leaving them there and inviting people to come on them and fall. But getting back on point, though, there is... tort law does give us the assurance. We can say, yeah, these stairways must be safe, because if they weren't safe, they would have taken them down because they would have been afraid of being sued. And most of the time, that's a pretty logical argument. So I think that kind of shows the success of our tort system. Although, you know, you can only take it so far. So if you see some unsafe condition, you can't take for granted that they know about it and they are concerned about getting sued, because maybe they don't take personal responsibility. So we all still have to be careful. And another common example of that is drug safety. If I, you know, my leading healthcare provider, well, now, you know, I'm afraid to go in there because of the coronavirus. But my primary healthcare provider, of course, is the Dollar Tree. If I need to buy some aspirin or some Tylenol or something, where do I go buy it? I go buy it at Dollar Tree because it's cheap. You get a bottle of acetaminophen for $1. You can't beat that price anywhere. So they're my their primary healthcare provider. Well, why can I rest so assured that the good people at Dollar Tree are concerned about my health, that they're not selling adulterated drugs? Well, because I know that they would not do it if there was any possibility that there was something wrong with those drugs. They would not allow it because they would be afraid of getting sued. So in that sense, I think the tort system is a great success, because I know I have that assurance of safety that I can get my non-prescription medicines at Dollar Tree, knowing full well that they are completely safe and effective, because if they weren't, they would have gotten sued. Now, like I say, we went to those of us who went to law school, the whole process is designed to be a little bit intimidating. And in our torts class, we spent weeks and weeks and weeks discussing the law of battery. A battery simply says that you can't hit somebody else, and if you hit somebody else, and you injure them, well, they're going to sue you. After several weeks of intensely scrutinizing these cases that we had in law school, discussing all of the fine points about battery, and just getting all stressed out that I was missing something and I didn't get it. Finally, one day it just suddenly dawned on me that wait a minute, I knew that before I started law school. I knew that you're not supposed to go and punch people. And I also knew that if I did go and punch somebody, they would probably sue me. So I didn't need to spend several weeks in law school figuring that out. And really, in those first 2 weeks of law school, I really didn't learn anything new, because I already knew that. Now, I did learn a few of the finer points, I guess, of the law of battery, but I didn't really learn anything I hadn't learned. And similarly, then we talked later on about negligence and so forth. We talked about strict liability, and I'll explain what all these terms mean later on. But it was, of course, the studying torts, it was kind of a grueling year of learning all this arcane material. And then toward the end of the year, we had one case, and it had just kind of in passing, this judge said, and I don't remember what case it was. Maybe if somebody's extremely interested in finding it, send me an email. By the way, any attorneys taking this program for CLE credit, feel free to email me any questions that come up, and I'll answer them within the time allowed by your CLE rules. But anyway, this case, you know, like I say, if you want email, like maybe I can find the site for it. But the judge in this case wrote one paragraph, and I realized that one paragraph summarized everything we had learned all year. So I'm going to save you a little bit of time. For those of you who are planning on going to law school, well, I'll save you a little bit of time here because I will summarize that paragraph for you. I will tell you everything there is to know about tort law in one paragraph. And what that one paragraph was, that we have tort law, and the law of torts does three things. It provides compensation to victims in three categories. First of all, the law says that you have to refrain from committing intentional harm to other people. So yes, if I punch you, that's not supposed to do that. Or if I trespass on your land, or if I break some of your property, if I do any of those things intentionally, I'm not supposed to do that. And I have to compensate you for any damages that I cause. The other thing that the law of torts does is it said in everything else, I have to use due care. I have to be careful whenever I'm doing anything else. So if I'm not, I can't take my car and intentionally crash it into you. But I also, even if I don't intend to crash into you, I have to drive carefully when I'm driving around. So if I'm not being careful, then I have to compensate any victims for any harm that I cause. And then finally, there are a handful of categories that are in a class of themselves that we as a society have just decided that if I'm engaging in this activity, even if I'm being really careful, it's the kind of activity where if somebody gets injured, it's really my responsibility to compensate them. So for example, if I am using dynamite and I'm just, just being extremely careful, but I need the dynamite, for some legitimate purpose. So I'm being just, extremely careful in using this dynamite and through no fault of my own and through no fault of yours, but just for some freak accident because I was using this dynamite, somebody gets injured. Well, I was using the dynamite for my benefit. You know, I was benefiting from the dynamite because I was getting rid of this stump or I was, building a mine or whatever. So I was the one benefiting from the dynamite. So it's really, again, that fairness category. You should not have to pay for the fact that I was benefiting from using the dynamite. So in that kind of small class of cases, and we'll talk about what those are in a little while, we decide that even if I'm not being negligent, even if I'm using due care, I'm still required to compensate you under the law of torts. At this point, I'm going to give our first code number for this section of the program. If you're taking the program for CLE credit, write this number down, unless you're driving, because we don't want to use due care. The first code number here is 5-151. 5-151. 5-1-5-1. 5-151 is our next code number. Okay, again, the code number is 5-151. And then we turn to the first of those three categories. We turn to intentional torts. When you got to law school, I think most law school curriculums start with that. You probably spent a few weeks talking about battery. Not Duracells, but battery. That means you batter somebody, you hit somebody. To sue somebody for battery and the other intentional torts that we'll talk about in a little while are generally the same. You have to have intent. Now, these are intentional torts. So if I punch you, I intended to punch you. You can sue me for battery. If I was just out, stretching my arms and my arm happened to bump into you, well, that's not battery because I did not intend that. Although perhaps I was negligent in stretching my arms when there were people close by. For there to be to sue somebody for battery or some other intentional tort, there has to be intent. But it's not. It does not mean I intended to cause you any harm. I was just kind of joking around, and I didn't, I didn't realize I was going to break your jaw. I was just kind of lightly tapping you with my fist. That doesn't matter because the kind of intent required for an intentional tort is merely the intention to have that kind of contact with the person. Yes, I intended for my hand to come in contact with your face. I didn't realize it was going to be that that harmful or anything. Well, for the intent, I did not have to intend to cause any harm. I only intended to had to intend to do that actual physical act. Again, this the same level of intent applies to trespassing. If I trespass on your property, and as my law school professor put it, the kind of intent required is the 1 foot in front of the other intent. I didn't have to know that it was your property. I didn't have to know that there was going to be something there that I would damage by stepping on it. The only intent that I had to have was the intention to put 1 foot in front of the other one. And as long as I have that, that's the required level of intent for any of the intentional torts. So in the case of battery, you have to intend to touch a person. But the actual battery, what is that? Well, that's having some harmful or offensive contact. So if I don't have to harm you by punching you, but as long as it offends you, that's enough. I do not have to actually cause any damages because the damages are kind of presumed in the case of an intentional tort. So if I come up behind you and slap you, I slapped you really lightly and, nobody was harmed or anything. Well, you can still sue me for battery. And the court will award some level of damages. It may only be $1, but at least, the damages are presumed. Damages are presumed when you commit an intentional tort. Consent. Obviously, in the case of an intentional tort, consent excuses the conduct. Now, it might vary a little bit. I'm not going to. I was about to use the word defense, some of these intentional tort cases, that would be the wrong word to use. It might just negate your case, because if you walked up to me and said, like Houdini famously, how Houdini famously died, allegedly, was somebody walked up to him and said, "Can I punch you in the stomach?" And Houdini said, "Sure, go ahead and punch me in the stomach." Now that's disputed whether or not he really said that, but let's say that he did. Well, then if I punch Houdini in the stomach and he's not ready to take the punch and I wind up killing him, I'm not guilty of battery because he consented to that. I said, "Houdini, can I punch you?" That's a pretty easy case. But on the other hand, the consent need not be expressed. I don't have to say, "I will allow you to touch me." So if I'm playing football with you, I never said, "It is okay for you to tackle me." I don't go up to the opposing team and say, "You can tackle me, you can tackle me, you can tackle me, and you can tackle me. I consent to any of you tackling me." Obviously, we're not going to say that, but it's implied from the circumstances. So consent negates all these intentional torts. Trespassing is an intentional tort. So if I walk on your land, you can sue me for walking on your land. You might not, I didn't cause any harm. I didn't cause any damages, but if I, If I'm cutting across your lawn as a shortcut, well, then you can sue me for trespassing. There's not really a requirement of warning or anything like that. On the other hand, there might be a question of consent. And there's kind of an implied consent that if you have a doorbell, well, I can walk up onto your property far enough to push the doorbell, because otherwise, why would the bell be there if people weren't allowed to walk up that far? But I can't walk in your house if the door is unlocked, because you obviously didn't consent to that. But you probably impliedly consented to me walking as far as the doorbell and pushing the button. Because otherwise, why would you put a doorbell there? You don't have too many cases of people suing for those intentional torts. One area where there is some litigation is in the area of false imprisonment. If somebody goes to a store and is engaging in shoplifting, can the employees of the store keep the suspect there? Until the police arrive. Well, the there's the intentional tort of false imprisonment, and what false imprisonment is restraining you against your will. You wanted to leave the store, and I say no, you can't leave the store. And in fact, I will if you try to use the store, I might use force against you. Well, that's the tort of false imprisonment, But there, on the other hand, there is a shopkeeper's privilege, which is a defense to a charge of false imprisonment. So if I reasonably believe that you were stealing something from me, especially if you really were stealing something from me, then that's probably a pretty good defense to a charge of false imprisonment. On the other hand, it's maybe kind of hard to prove it in court. So that's why maybe a lot of stores just say, you know what, it's not worth it. We'll lose a certain amount of merchandise, but if we apprehend shoplifters and a jury decides we weren't being reasonable about it, well, if you're not being reasonable about it, then it is a case of false imprisonment, and they err on the side of caution and just say, you know what, if the real cops aren't here to enforce the law, we're not going to try to apprehend somebody. So those are some of the intentional torts. In law school, you learn a few others like, trespass to chattels, or conversion, taking somebody else's property, or trespassing to their chattels, using somebody's personal property without their permission. But again, the same general principles apply. It has to be intentional. But that intent is not, intent to cause harm. It's just intent to do the thing that you're doing. And also the other one of the things that we spent an excruciating amount of time on in torts class was the eggshell skull rule. So if I come up to you and tap you on the side of the head, you suffer millions of dollars of damages, because you have an eggshell skull, and I cracked your skull because of that. Well, I didn't know you had an eggshell skull. If I had known you had an eggshell skull, I certainly wouldn't have done that. I just didn't know. But again, the level of intent that's required is not the intent to do harm. I didn't intend to do any harm in that case, but I did intend to tap you on the side of the head without your permission. I am responsible for those damages because I acted intentionally. The damages don't have to be reasonably foreseeable or anything like that. Now, when we move into our next category, negligence, then maybe the damages have to be reasonable. They have to be foreseeable. But intentional torts, they don't have to. So if I come up to you with an eggshell skull and break your eggshell skull, not knowing of your particular condition, well, that's my tough luck. I have to pay the full damages, even though I had no clue about that. Well, our next category is indeed negligence. And you hear the word negligence a lot. McDonald's was you know, being negligent in handing this boiling coffee to the person. They didn't intend to cause any harm, but in fact, the person consented. They said, do you consent to me giving you this cup of coffee? Well, of course I do. That's why I paid for it. So obviously that's not an intentional tort. That was a case of negligence or alleged negligence. And what does negligence mean? Well, you know, and again, negligence is what most people think of when they think of tort lawsuits. And negligence is failing to act with reasonable care. In my one paragraph summary of tort law, we learned that there are three categories: intentional torts, negligence, not using reasonable care, and then those other miscellaneous category like dynamite that we call strict liability. So the second category is negligence, failing to act with reasonable care. So was I being careful enough? And if I'm not being careful enough, I'm responsible for any damages that result. And what do I have to do? What's my duty? Well, I have to act with reasonable care. What's reasonable care? Well, what reasonable care is what a reasonable person would do under those circumstances. So I'm driving 100 miles an hour down a residential street. Well, that's not reasonable care because a reasonable person would not do that. A reasonable person would decide that it's dangerous. Well, what is a reasonable person? Well, that's for the jury to decide. That's a question of fact. And the jury really has to decide. So most of these negligence cases, it really is a question for the jury to decide. We, our Seventh Amendment right says that we have a right to a jury trial in civil cases of $10 or more. Well, the reason why is because we, at least with things that are valued at more than $10, we trust the judgment of our fellow citizens to decide what a reasonable person would do in those circumstances. So whatever you do, you have to act reasonably. You have to use reasonable care. But on the other hand, you in general do not have a duty to act. So if I'm walking down the street minding my own business, and I see a kid in the street and a car barreling down on them, I don't have any duty to do anything. The law does not impose any obligation on me to do any act. I do not have to rescue anybody. If I see somebody drowning, I don't have to go out and try to rescue them. I in general, there's never a duty to act. Now, there might be an exception to that if I caused the peril in the first place, maybe even in a very minor way. So somebody came up to me and, how's the swimming here? And I just, kind of nonchalantly say, oh yeah, great swimming here. And then they get in the water and start swimming. And, maybe I do have a duty to rescue, in that case, because, I kind of told them that that would be a good place to be. But in general, I don't have a duty to act. And as the text points out, well, that sounds horrible. You know, everybody should, rescue somebody, especially if there's no risk to yourself, you should do that. But, the law just doesn't impose that because because that would be kind of a slippery slope, as they say, that if we said there was a duty to rescue, then, where do we draw the line? And as the author points out, well, the world is populated with good Samaritans. So, in general, most people do not need the law motivating them to say, go rescue somebody who is in peril. But in general, there's no duty to rescue, even though there is a duty, again, to use reasonable care, a duty to do what the reasonable person would need. On the other hand, to whom do you owe this duty? And there, of course, if you went to law school, you hear about this Paul's Graf case, whereas kind of this, bizarre chain of circumstances where somebody did something negligent. I think it was a train conductor negligently pushed somebody into a train. You know, everybody agrees that they were being negligent. That was just not the thing for this train conductor to do, pushing somebody into the train before the door closed. Well, as a result of pushing this guy into the train, the person being pushed, nothing happened to them. Everything went fine. They got in the train, except they dropped their bag of fireworks. So I suppose that person could have sued for the loss of their bag of fireworks. But as far as I know, they never sued for that. But they dropped this bag of fireworks. And because they dropped this bag of fireworks, it was kind of a fluke, but the fireworks went off and there was this loud explosion. And that shook a scale at the other end of the platform. And because that scale shook, something fell down and hit this other person way down the way. So the person who was injured by this falling object, they sued the railroad because the conductor was negligently pushed this person. And in a famous opinion by Judge Cardozo of the New York Court of Appeals in 1928, the Palsgraf case, they said no, because you only owe a duty to a person in your zone of danger. Just because you committed this negligent act does not mean that you're responsible for every bizarre little thing that might happen in the universe as a result of that. You're only liable to people who were within what I think Judge Cardozo called the zone of danger. The passenger we're pushing in was in the zone of danger. And yeah, you should have been really careful. And if he had been injured, yeah, he could have sued you because you were being negligent. But it was just utterly unforeseeable, the fact that these fireworks went off and that caused this scale at the other end of the platform to injure somebody. So yeah, you owe a duty of due care, but only to people kind of within the zone of danger. It has to be, you're not liable to the whole world just because you did one negligent act. I mentioned in the, if I punch you, you can sue me for my intentional tort, even if you didn't have any actual damages. You will win if I batter you, even if you don't have any damages. You might only win $1, but at least you win something. Well, in a negligence case though, you do have to have damages. But on the other hand, it can't be mere economic damages. And the example that the author uses, I think, is a good one, is that if I get into a car crash in a tunnel, and I'm blocking the tunnel. So I'm negligent. I was not being careful and I crash into you. So obviously I have to pay for your car because I was negligent and you had damages, physical damages. But because of that accident, we are blocking the highway. And everybody behind us, can't get in the tunnel. On the traffic report on the radio, they say there's an accident blocking the Lowry Tunnel, and I was responsible for it. And as a result of that, thousands of people are late for work. Those people are not allowed to sue for their mere economic damages. The guy I crashed into, whose car I totaled, he was late for work. Maybe I'm responsible for those damages, but those other people who had mere economic harm, the people behind us who were late for work, as a result of my negligence, I'm probably not liable for their damages. Kind of a similar rule is what about emotional harm? I crash into you, as a result of that, you are having nightmares now about car accidents. I am probably responsible for those damages, and I will have to compensate you because you're now having these nightmares about car accidents. because you were, you know, again, within that zone of danger. You were, you know, a person who is all, who also had physical damages. You might have had some personal injuries, and you had some damage to your vehicle. So therefore, you were, I'm probably also responsible for your emotional harm. But the other people who see this gruesome accident, even if they have nightmares, I probably don't have to compensate them for their nightmares because they were not really within the zone of danger. And we have to draw the line somewhere. So I have a duty to be careful. What exactly is that duty to be careful? Well, I have to use reasonable care. What the reasonable person would think. So again, we entrust it to these lay persons to figure out what it is. But one, if you want to get it a little bit more scientific, then we turn to Judge Learned Hand. I always wonder what Mr. and Mrs. Hand were thinking when they named their little baby Learned. But he went on to become a very learned judge. On the U.S. Court of Appeals. And in 1947, he was famously the author of a case called the United States versus Carroll Towing. And the Carroll Towing case was, I don't know what happened. It was some kind of barge accident or something. But he defined what reasonable care was in mathematical terms. And he famously used the inequality, I was going to say equation, but it's really an inequality of B is less than PL. You are negligent if B is less than PL. And what are those? So this works great in economic cases. B is how much is the burden to you? How much does it cost? How much is the burden for you to be careful in this particular case? L is the amount of the loss. So how much loss will result if this kind of accident happens? And P is what is the probability of this kind of accident? So let's say that there's a there's a $1 million car parked out here, and I'm doing something that there is a 1 in 100 chance that my doing this thing will cause that harm. So there's a 1% chance that I will destroy this $1 million piece of property. So in other words, if you've studied statistics at all, you'll recognize that what we're talking about is that's something called the expected value. What's the expected value of this particular conduct? Well, the expected value is the probability times the amount of loss. So on average, if I do this thing, there's a 1% chance that I will cause $1 million worth of damage. Therefore, on average, I will cause $10,000 in damage if I do this thing that I'm about to do. Well, the question then becomes is, well, what's the burden on me for not doing that thing? It might be, you know, just a trivial burden. I shouldn't play with firecrackers next to your $1 million car, because if I play with firecrackers near your $1 million car, on average, every time I do that, I'm going to cause $10,000 worth of damage. So the burden of me not shooting off firecrackers next to your car certainly less than $10,000. So in that case, I would be negligent if I set off a firecracker next to your car, even though there's only a 1% chance I'm going to do some harm. On the other hand, I have an injured person in my car that I have to rush to the hospital. It might be worth $10,000 to me to get to the hospital in time by speeding past your car. even though on average, every time I speed past your car, it's going to cause $10,000 in damage. But the value of getting somebody safely to the hospital is greater than $10,000. So in that case, I would not be negligent. So even though the harm is and the probability of the harm is exactly the same, in one case I'm negligent, in one case I'm not. And the example the author gives is, do you put a fence around your little league field? So the little league baseball team is playing, and occasionally, you know, they'll hit a baseball out of the park. But it doesn't happen very often. The probability of that happening is very low, and the risk of damage is pretty low too. Because, yeah, one time out of 1,000, it'll they'll hit a ball out of the park, and it'll break somebody's window. Well, you know, the window costs $100. So therefore, the probability P times L is a pretty trivial amount of money, because both the amount of loss and the probability of that happening are pretty low, whereas the cost of putting up a tall fence would be much higher than that. So B is not less than PL, so that would not be negligence, not putting a fence around your little league baseball field. On the other hand, if you're in a hockey arena, you probably do need plexiglass guards around in front of the fans, because those plexiglass shields are pretty expensive, but the probability of somebody hitting a hockey puck out into the stands is pretty high, and the loss is also pretty high, because if probably in every game, you know, they're gonna some hockey player is going to hit a hockey puck out into the stands, and it's going to hit somebody. And if it does hit somebody, well, those things are going pretty fast and it causes a pretty severe injury. So there, putting up that fence, in that case, a plexiglass shield, would be called for under Judge Learned Hand's B is less than PL test. Conceivably, the reasonable person would look at things that way also. Okay, on page 159, the author starts talking about, well, how do we prove negligence? And just a couple of points there. First of all, often it's circumstantial evidence. You don't have somebody seeing the smoking gun in action. Oftentimes it's circumstantial evidence. And kind of the extreme case of circumstantial evidence is a doctrine, that one of the first Latin phrases you learned in law school was res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. So there's a legal doctrine of res ipsa loquitur for situations where, kind of the ultimate in circumstantial evidence, but pretty compelling circumstantial evidence. And the example we always get in law school is, you come out of surgery and, there's a sponge left in you. You ask the doctor, hey, doc, did you leave a sponge inside me? Well, no, I didn't do it. And you ask the rest of the operating team and say, we didn't see anybody leave any sponges in there. I guess you can't sue us. But res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. That's pretty strong circumstantial evidence, because you were the only person operating on me recently, and nobody else could have left it there. You had sole control over the instrumentality. You were in charge of the sponges. So if you wake up after your surgery and there's a sponge left inside of you, well, you can probably prove that case pretty easily using the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. But again, almost any negligence case is going to involve some circumstantial evidence. The other thing to remember about negligence cases is that they often require expert testimony. When we talked about the law of evidence, we talked a little bit about this, that most witnesses are fact witnesses. They say, just the facts. This is what I saw. But an expert witness, such as a medical doctor, saying, in my opinion, this sponge left inside of the person causes the following kinds of injuries. negligence cases often call for expert testimony, both as to damages, you know, what was the result of the sponge being left in the person, or, you know, was this a design defect? The gas tank on this Pinto, was that mounted properly? Could it have been done in a safer fashion? So oftentimes you'll have an expert testifying about that. Oftentimes there will be evidence of custom. The example, what evidence of what other people do, what's normally done. The example cited by the author was the use of shatterproof glass in a shower. This plaintiff sued his landlord because he fell down in the shower and the glass in the shower door was just plain old glass, and he cut himself. He said, the landlord was negligent because the landlord should have put shatterproof glass in there. And one of the ways that that's proven by saying, look, most landlords use shatterproof glass. So evidence of custom might come in. Something like a statute is also used to prove negligence often, such as, for example, a speed limit. I'm tooling down 100 miles an hour on residential streets. The speed limit is 30 miles an hour. And in fact, by the time you hear this, the speed limit, the City Council of St. Paul will have lowered the speed limit to 25 miles an hour. I'm driving way in excess of that speed limit. Well, that's evidence of my negligence, the fact that I'm violating this statute. But it generally has to be a statute that's safety related. For example, my driver's license expires on my birthday. There's a statute that says you're not supposed to drive if you don't have a valid driver's license. So one day after my birthday, I'm driving along careful as can be, but I crash into somebody. They probably can't say, well, wait a minute, I wouldn't have been in this accident if you hadn't been driving illegally. I say, well, yeah, I was driving illegally, but that's not a safety related issue. The fact that my driver's license expired one day ago. If it's a safety related statute, like the speed limit, then that clearly would be evidence. Now, I kind of hinted at the next subject here. We're going to talk about causation. That's the next topic we talk about. You spent an interminable amount of time in law school talking about causation. I just used causation type language. I said, if I hadn't been driving without a driver's license, then I wouldn't have caused this injury. But for my lack of a driver's license. So that was causation, except that was not negligence. But if I'm doing something negligent, that's where we use that reasoning to see if there's causation. It's but for causation. But for my driving 100 miles an hour, this person would not have been injured. If I had been driving a reasonable speed, this accident would not have happened. But for my speeding, this accident would not have happened. And that's one of the elements. That's one of the things you have to prove a negligence case. You have to prove that there's causation. But for my negligence, this wouldn't have happened. Now, there might be some exceptions to that, though. For example, what about concurrent negligence? What if two people are being negligent at the same time? I'm driving 100 miles an hour, and this other person is driving 100 miles an hour down the street, and we both crash into the same person. I guess I could come in and say, well, wait a minute, I'm not responsible for this accident, because even if I hadn't been speeding, this other person would have, by fluke, caused the same accident. Well, I can't do that, because there the courts would say that's concurrent negligence. Maybe you can use statistical evidence to prove causation. Maybe. You probably need an expert witness to do that. If I'm exposed to asbestos and I get cancer, who's to say that maybe I would have been in the 1% of people who would have gotten this kind of cancer, even if I hadn't been exposed to the asbestos. So in that case, maybe some statistical evidence will come in and say, we're not 100% sure, but we're 99% sure. One thing that the... So that's the level of causation. Now, one thing the author doesn't really talk about that you spend interminable hours in law school talking about is proximate cause. A lot of the cases and a lot of your maybe your old sainted law school professor didn't like the word proximate cause. They instead wanted to use the word legal cause because in addition to something being the but-for cause, it also has to be the proximate cause. And proximate cause means, well, it has to be close. It has to be proximate. The damage had to be caused closely by what you did. Well, that doesn't make any sense. So that's why a lot of your law school professors prefer the word legal cause. But it just says that if something is really remote, then even if, yeah, theoretically you caused this accident, we're not going to assess legal liability of that. And there we go back to that Paul's Graph case. And that's one way you could look on that case is a case of proximate cause, of there not being any proximate cause. That, yeah, the conductor was negligent. He pushed this person into the train, and that was not using due care. That was negligence. It was the cause of the accident, because if he had not pushed this person in, then this person would have gone on his way and taken his fireworks miles away. But instead, he did that. But for his negligence, this person, on the other side of the platform would not have been injured. So one way of looking at that case is to say, well, yeah, that was the but-for cause, but that was not the proximate cause of the accident. That person was not proximate enough. They were literally, in that case, too far away. That's kind of a good example of proximate cause, maybe a good use of that word. But that line about what is proximate and what is not is really... it's just a bunch of cases talking about that, really about what's fair in particular circumstances. So ultimately, it doesn't have too much to do with whether or not the person is proximate, whether they are close or not. It's really more just what judges have decided over the years. So therefore, the word legal cause is actually a better term. But the injuries have to be caused by the accident, and that means they have to be the but-for cause. In a logical sense, they had to have been caused by it, but they also have to be the proximate cause or the legal cause. That Paul's Graph case is a good example of what's not proximate cause. We can debate for a whole semester in law school what is proximate cause or what is legal cause. But just keep in mind that the judges, if something is really remote, will not allow a verdict against somebody if it's not proximate enough, whatever that word proximate means. Okay, so sometimes, this bad guy, this tortfeasor is responsible. What if the victim is partially responsible? And that's covered by the author on page 162. Traditionally, a hundred years ago, the traditional stance was, we call that contributory negligence. So I was being unsafe, driving my horse too fast on the street, but you were not being entirely careful yourself either. So you were a little bit negligent. You were a little bit at fault, and you got injured. Well, you can't sue me because we call that contributory negligence. If you contributed to your own injuries by your negligence, then I'm not responsible. That maybe is not too very fair, because maybe I was being a lot more negligent than you were. A lot of courts have then at some point moved to a rule of, well, yeah, it's contributory negligence, but we will we will decide who was how much at fault. So I was 90% at fault because I was just really negligent. You were only 10% at fault because, yeah, you were negligent, but not nearly as negligent as I was. And how do you quantify those things? Well, you can't, but you have to anyway. You have to assign a percentage. I was 90% at fault. You were 10% at fault. Therefore, I'm still liable to you. I caused, $1,000 damage to you, and I was 90% at fault. Well, then I have to pay 90% of the damages. I pay you $900, even though you have a medical bill of $1,000, because 10% of it really belongs to you as your comparative negligence, we call that. With comparative negligence, you assign percentage. And different courts do that different ways, different jurisdictions. Traditionally, it was that if I am 50% or less, then I don't, then I'm not responsible at all. So if you were 51% negligent and I was 49% negligent, then I don't have to pay you anything because you were more than me. Other states might have pure comparative negligence, they call it. So you were 99% at fault. I was only 1% at fault, but you were the one who was injured, so therefore I have to pay you 1% of your injuries. That's called pure comparative negligence. And different states will do that differently. Minnesota is uses the 50% rule. And I always forget whether it's Minnesota, it's actually... it's straight 50%. Because some states, is it 50% or is it 51%? In Minnesota, it's 50%, I believe. Maybe somebody can correct me on that. And again, but again, you have to check your own state law. Another doctrine we talk about in negligence is assumption of the risk. If I'm going to go to an indoor climbing facility, well, they won't let me in the door unless I sign this paper saying that, don't worry, I'm not going to sue you if something goes wrong. That's an express assumption of the risk. I sign a paper saying that if I get injured or if my kids get injured here, we promise not to sue you. Is that enforceable? It may be enforceable. It may not be enforceable. That's certainly going to be one of the subjects of the litigation when it comes up. If it was just ordinary negligence on their part, then it's probably enforceable. But if they were really negligent, then maybe it's not enforceable. Also, for some essential product, if I go to the vertical climbing wall, I can just say, I'm not going to sign this assumption of the risk because it looks dangerous to me. On the other hand, if I go into a grocery store, if I go into the supermarket and buy a gallon of milk, and they say, we're not going to sell you this gallon of milk until you sign this paper. And the paper says, if the milk turns out to be poison, you can't sue us. In that case, it would probably be thrown out right away because, buying milk is kind of an essential product. There's also the question, that's express assumption of the risk. There's also something called an implied assumption of the risk. If I engage in an activity that's obviously dangerous, well, then I'm going to realize that it's obviously dangerous. But on the other hand, that might just be another way of saying the other side was not negligent. So if I... If I decide to borrow your hang gliding outfit jump off a cliff with your hang gliding stuff on and get injured, well, maybe I should have realized that there were some inherent risks in that activity. And if I'm injured by one of those inherent risks, then maybe I can't sue you for negligence. But on the other hand, maybe that's just another way of saying that you were not negligent to start with because that was an inherent risk. At this point, we will give our next code number for this portion of the program, which is 5-297. 5-297. 5-297 is our next code number for this portion of the program. And we turn to strict liability. As remember, I told you in that paragraph that I discovered at the end of the year in my torts book that tort law does three things. No intentional injury, you have to be careful. And some activities, you're going to be liable even if you were as careful as you possibly could be, because they are abnormally dangerous activities. As you remember from law school, you'll vaguely recall the name of Rylands versus Fletcher, which was an 1868 case from England, where somebody had a big reservoir of water on their property because they, for their mill or whatever, they needed this big reservoir of water. So they had a dam on their property and all this water piled up. And then one day, the dam broke and it flooded the people on the neighboring property and they sued. And the owner of the property, I don't know if it was Rylands or Fletcher, but they said, well, wait, we were as careful as possibly could be. We built this dam. It was the best dam ever built, we used every ounce of care that was humanly possible. It was just a freak accident that caused the dam to break, so we should not be liable for negligence. And in a negligence case, they would have won. But the court said, well, wait a minute, though, that's keeping a large quantity of water on your property behind a dam. That's an abnormally dangerous activity. And you were the one, by running your factory there or whatever reason you had the pool of water, you were benefiting from having that reservoir of water. Your neighbor was not benefiting from that in any way. So why should they have to bear the damage that came from that? In an abnormally dangerous activity, such as a big reservoir of water, you are strictly liable. The other side does not have to prove negligence. If you have a dangerous animal, that might apply. So if you have a dog or a cat, that's probably okay. And if you're being really careful, but they bite somebody anyway, you're probably not liable for that because you were not negligent. But if you keep a lion in your property, or if you maybe a dog that's already bit somebody or something, and then through no fault of your own, your lion escapes and bites somebody, why should the person who's bit bear the burden of that, because you were the one who had the benefit of having this lion the whole time? Or as I mentioned earlier, explosives. I need explosives for my job, because I'm a miner, and I'm trying to put this dynamite in the ground to get the coal out of the ground. I'm being just as careful as possible, but through some freak accident, the dynamite causes some damage to you. Well, why should you have to bear that burden because I was the one who was getting the benefit of that inherently dangerous activity? So strict liability is imposed there, and more recently, products liability. So if I sell a product that's unreasonably dangerous, and I didn't do anything particular negligent about it, but I'm selling this product and it's just unreasonably dangerous, whatever that means, it's up to a jury to decide what that means, that it's unreasonably dangerous. But if I sell you a Pinto with the gas tank mounted in the back in such a place that it'll explode if somebody bumps into it, you can't point to any specific negligent thing I did in producing that, but it's unreasonably dangerous. And so why should you bear the damages for that? The court would impose that liability on me because I got the economic advantage out of producing that car, even though it was unreasonably dangerous. And, so it's up to me to make it not unreasonably dangerous. So it might be a design defect like that. On the other hand, this is one area, where tort reform comes in and says, well, wait a minute, maybe that Pinto is a lot cheaper. Maybe people have the right to decide that, they're just willing to take that risk. So there's a pendulum that swings in those cases where the court's going to look at the risk and the benefits of it. Also, failure to warn might be a thing in a products liability case. If they cover up the fact that the gas tank is right back there, you have the additional claim that says, "Wait a minute, it was unreasonably dangerous because they never warned me. Nobody told me that this gas tank was in a bad position back there." So that's products liability. It kind of comes under the category of strict liability. It's not kind of like an abnormally dangerous activities, but an unreasonably dangerous product triggers strict liability. In any kind of negligence or strict liability case, in a intentional tort, if I punch you, I'm liable even if there are not any actual damages. But in most torts cases, in a negligence case or a strict liability case, there have to be actual damages. I have to say I'm out X dollars because of this, or I have pain and suffering. I'm in pain now because of this accident, and I should be compensated for that. But there has to be actual damages, and those are called compensatory damages. They're compensating me for my loss, and there has to be some kind of compensable loss, something that you can put a dollar value on. Unlike the intentional tort, where if I punch you, you can sue me, even if you didn't have any damages at all. You're going to get something, even if it's only $1. The other thing to remember about damages that make the tort system, maybe it has to be done this way just out of efficiency, but one thing that makes it an imperfect system is those damages are awarded once. If you sue me, for something, you might win $1 million for your hospital bills and the pain and suffering from the rest of your life. So the jury, it really has to estimate what those damages are going to be for the rest of your life, because you can't come back later and say, "Well, you know what? The pain and suffering is actually worse than I thought it was. That $1 million I got wasn't enough. I need $2 million." Well, tough. You had your one try at it. On the other hand, if you get $1 million damages, and then I don't feel that bad after all. That's not going to change things. Once that amount is awarded, it's not going to change. So that makes the system maybe a little bit imperfect, because who's to know what's going to happen in the future. The other thing with tort reform, especially, judges are very aware of the possibility of excessive verdicts. Another phrase that comes in there is remittitur. Sometimes that will happen. The judge will look at the case and say, "You know what? The $1 million damages in this case, that's too high. So I'm going to affirm the jury's finding, but only if you agree to take less than what they awarded." That's called remittitur. And that's actually what happened in the McDonald's case. The jury awarded some punitive damages, we'll talk about in a minute, of millions of dollars. And the judge really cut them down a lot. So yeah, the jury awarded millions and millions of dollars, but the judge chopped that down almost immediately to a much lower amount. And there's another thing called additur, which the author points out doesn't happen very often, where the judge says, "You know what, the jury did not award enough money, so I'll affirm the verdict, but only if you agree to add a little bit to it." Some states have a cap on non-economic damages, so pain and suffering. There might be a state cap put in by the legislature in response to tort reform advocates. If you're a litigator, you need to be aware of if there are caps on non-economic damages in the state. At this point, I'm going to give our third, and it will be final, code number. We have a few more things to talk about. Our third and final code number for this section of the program is 5-361. 5-361. 5-361 is our third code word for this portion of the program. Before we tell you just a little bit about punitive damages. In the McDonald's case, the jury awarded punitive damages because they thought the temperature of this coffee shocked the conscience. They thought it was outrageous, or they were applying some standard similar to that, that the reason why these punitive damages are awarded is not to compensate the victim, but instead to punish the defendant or to deter the defendant from future activity. And as the author points out, that could also be accomplished through the criminal and administrative system. So if, you know, that's another way to punish or deter behavior. But in the right case, if the defendant's conduct shocks the conscience of the jury, then they might be able to award punitive damages. But that doesn't happen very often. Even in cases that go to verdict, that go to trial and there's a verdict, maybe only 1 to 2% of those cases get any punitive damages. And certainly cases that settle out of court probably don't get any punitive damages. So it's very rarely awarded. It's often cited by the tort reform advocates, but really not awarded very often. So punitive damages. And again, many states will have caps on the amount of punitive damages that can be awarded in the case, because there's this fear that there are these runaway juries just awarding punitive damages willy-nilly. So therefore, the court or some state legislatures have passed laws saying punitive damages cannot go over a certain dollar amount. So anyway, there we are. Well, that brings us up to the end of Chapter 5. You know, you have a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what the law of torts sounds like. So I look forward to moving on to our next lesson, Lesson 6. If you just stumbled upon this program and you're not sure what it is, you can find out more at my website, richardclem.com. RichardClem.com. You get all the information on this and other continuing legal education programs.